From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
I'd like to take this opportunity to commend the commitment, engagement, and leadership of all the heads of state and government, ministers, and negotiators, and many members of delegation who have brought us so far in these very difficult negotiations.
That was the Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, at the closing of the COP21 in Paris this past Saturday, after an agreement that he called, quote, a monumental triumph for people and planet, close quote, was reached. The agreement aims to cap the rise in global temperature to below 2 degrees Celsius. That agreement is the product of 2 weeks of negotiations among representatives of the 196 members of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. Cristina Silveiro was in Paris and filed this report.
To the sound of impassioned applause and a room-wide standing ovation, the Paris Agreement on Climate Change was adopted on Saturday at COP21 by the parties to the UN Convention on Climate Change. Soon after its adoption, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon told delegates they had made history and had entered a new era of global cooperation on one of the most complex issues ever to confront humanity. The UN chief said negotiators reached solid results on all key points with an agreement that demonstrates solidarity.
All countries have agreed to hold global temperature rise to well below 2 degrees Celsius, and recognizing the risk of grave consequences, you have further agreed to pursue efforts to limit temperature increase to 1.5 degrees. You have listened to the voices of the most vulnerable and recognized the importance of minimizing and addressing loss and damage. This is especially important for the nations of Africa, small island developing states, and least developed countries.
Highlighting the role of the private sector, the UN chief said business leaders came to Paris in unprecedented numbers. He added that with the agreement, markets now have the clear signal they need to unleash the full force of human ingenuity and scale up investments that will generate low emissions and resilient growth. Cristina Silveiro, United Nations, reporting from COP21 in Paris.
The new Cold War between NATO and Russia is beginning to look more and more like a hot war. Less than 3 weeks after NATO member Turkey shot down a Russian plane over Syria using a pair of American-made F-16s, a Russian destroyer Sunday fired warning shots at a Turkish fishing vessel, which was sailing on a collision course towards them, after it failed to respond to calls from the warship. CCTV's Natalie Carney filed this report from Istanbul.
Right now, all the information we are being provided with is from the Russian Defense Ministry, who basically said that their destroyer, the Smetlevi, was anchored just off the Greek island of Lemnos, and the Turkish fishing boat came within 500 meters of it. And they say despite numerous attempts by the crew, the Turkish fishing boat did not make radio contact and did not respond to visual signals by the Smetlevi. So they were then forced to ignite a small arms fire, basically, to set off small arms fire at the direction of the Turkish vessel in a range that they say was not lethal, but to warn it to avoid any collision. We have not heard any comment from the Turkish government, but on Friday, Turkey's Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu did warn that Ankara's patience with Russia was not unlimited and did accuse Moscow of using every opportunity to punish Turkey for the downing of their plane over what Turkey says was Turkish airspace in late November. Since then, the two sides have been going head-to-head. There's been a lot of accusations from Moscow against Ankara and vice versa. So this is just another incident in an increasing list of disagreements between both sides.
That incident was followed hours later by another encounter between Russian warships and a Turkish vessel, this one involving an intervention by a Russian missile cruiser and Coast Guard powerboat after a merchant vessel flying the Turkish flag hampered a Russian convoy transporting two drill platforms to a new location in Russian territorial waters near Crimea. While the two rigs were being moved to their new location, the vessel flying the Turkish flag crossed the convoy's path acting, according to the owner of the rigs, quote, in violation of regulations for preventing collision and against the generally accepted conventions of navigation, closed quote. That owner, Chernomor Neftegas, said in a statement that the captain of the Turkish vessel operated radio silence despite requests to respond. Iraqi top officials and lawmakers convened at the country's parliament to discuss the Turkish deployment of troops to Iraq. Following that meeting, Iraq's foreign minister, Ibrahim al-Jarfari, reiterated Baghdad's commitment to resolving the issue through diplomatic means. The country's top official, however, warned that other means could be used if violation of Iraq's sovereignty continues. Press TV's Altaf Ahmad filed this report from Baghdad.
Iraq's territorial integrity at stake. That's the warning issued by top Iraqi officials after convening at the parliament to discuss Turkey's invasion of Iraqi soil. In a presser held at the parliament, Foreign Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari has reiterated that the country will not allow, quote, any violation of its sovereignty.
For us, the sovereignty of Iraq is a red line. We have the liberty of allowing advisors into Iraq, but we cannot accept the incursion of foreign armed troops and the establishment of foreign military bases on Iraqi territory.
A Turkish delegation, including Turkish Foreign Ministry's Under Secretary Feridun Seneli Oglu and head of Turkey's National Intelligence Organization Hakan Fidan, met with al-Jafari to discuss this issue recently. Al-Jafari says he is surprised that the Turkish delegation has failed to fulfill its promise made during the meeting.
The Turkish delegation had accepted our call for an immediate withdrawal of the Turkish troops. They said this issue will be announced as soon as they arrive to Turkey. However, we were surprised to hear from the Turkish President Erdogan saying otherwise and asserting that the Turkish troops will stay in Iraq.
Iraqi parliamentarians have also slammed a recent bipartisan bill passed unanimously by the U.S. House Foreign Affairs Committee, which they say targets Iraq's sovereignty as well. The bill authorizes bypassing the central government and directly arming and training Kurdish troops in northern Iraq.
The Turkish delegation had given us a preliminary approval to our call for an immediate withdrawal of the Turkish troops. They said this approval will be announced as soon as they arrive in Turkey. However, we were surprised to hear from the Turkish President Erdogan saying otherwise and asserting that the Turkish troops will stay in Iraq.
Observers say the Iraqi government is being put to the test by both Turkey and its allies in NATO and the so-called U.S.-led coalition, as well as by its own people. For now, the central government has received a green light to take all necessary measures in response to the Turkish act. It remains to be seen what Baghdad's next move will be. Altaf Ahmad, Press TV, Baghdad.
The past few weeks have seen right-wing gains in Argentina and Venezuela. Venezuela's election a week ago Sunday put a two-thirds majority in charge of the National Assembly, while the previous week's election in Argentina put a right-wing president in charge of that Latin American country. We discussed this last week with a number of our analysts and closed the week with a discussion with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. We now bring you part two of that discussion.
So you were referring to, gave a brief outline of the history there in Nicaragua and some of the things that were in play in 1990 when the Chamorro won. And that the right was attempting to, you know, some of the things they were attempting to roll back were things that were constructed during the 1980s, even under a state of siege, literally. And there was quite a bit, actually, that had been constructed during that time. There was the literacy campaign. There was medical care made available to people. There were attempts to address extreme poverty that were successful, particularly given the objective conditions of, you know, being under in a state of war, basically.
Right.
And those things build constituencies and people that have health care for the first time in their lives don't just walk away from it when a right-wing government's elected and says you can't have that anymore. They don't generally do that willingly. The people that can read, for example, don't become illiterate again when a right-wing government comes into power. What has been accomplished in Venezuela because of the, you know, different conditions that they had, and you know, and just in general, objectively, things, you know, were more favorable than things were for Nicaragua in the 80s. They've constructed a great deal of things. One of the things we've talked about a few times is, for example, they're going to finish their 1 millionth housing unit this month out of a population of 30 million. That's a lot. It's like a sixth of the population has new housing. That before,
yeah, massive achievement.
They're not going to go gently into that good night, those people, no matter what decrees come out of the new assembly. If you look at the focus, it seems from what Maduro said the other day that one of the things they're looking to do is activate the grassroots and get on with the, you know, maybe we can't get funding from the from this group in the National Assembly to do some of the construction of the apparatus of socialism that we wanted. We still have hands, we still have each other, and we still have what's been built so far. He's looking to move, to continue constructing socialism within whatever the political context ends up being. What kind of tasks do you think are before them, and how, I mean, it's an interesting approach to it, and it's one that's been discussed in theory before, but this is going to be a very significant example of praxis here.
Yeah, and it's impossible to say how things are going to pan out in its specifics, isn't it? And the, you can talk about in general what the task ahead of Nicolas Maduro, and the main one is the economy. And I don't know if you saw the article about, that Mark Weiss brought, who we mentioned last time we talked, and he's an economist who works with Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
Yeah,
and he has a very thorough and long understanding of the economic dynamics in Latin America in particular. And so, and what Weisbrot's saying is that one of the key things that obviously that Maduro has to address is the very complex problem of the exchange rate and trying to bring inflation under control. And those are key things that, and people here regarded the vote last Sunday as in many ways a kind of punishment vote against Maduro. I'm sure you'll have discussed this over the last few days, yes, with other people.
Yes.
But, and if you're an ordinary person, you're struggling to make ends meet in the best of circumstances, and you then still find that you have to queue for hours in order to buy basic stuff like bread and, you know, basic food items and items of daily life, then you're going to get very fed up. And that's obviously something that played a huge part in the electoral behavior last Sunday. So those key things, dealing with inflation, dealing with shortages, those are things that Nicolas Maduro is going to have to address. And will he have time to address them is a good question.
Mm.
And he's going to have to mobilize support immediately in the case of an attempt by the Venezuelan opposition to instigate a recall procedure, because Venezuela has the most democratic constitution in the world, far more democratic than the United States or Western Europe.
Yeah.
And one of the key provisions in it, as you know very well, is that halfway through a presidential term, if a certain number of people, I've forgotten what the figure is, I think the minimum number is 2 million people, or I've forgotten the exact number. If a certain number of people sign a petition demanding a recall referendum, they can enforce the Electoral Council. That obliges the Electoral Council to hold a referendum in which what's at stake is whether or not the president continues in office.
Right.
Now, it's very likely that the Venezuelan opposition will go and do that. So in parallel with whatever measures Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues are able to take to address the urgent problem of shortages of basic goods and the urgent problem of inflation. In parallel with that, he's going to have to build support that will enable him to win any recall referendum that the Venezuelan opposition try to set in motion later in 2016.
Right.
So there, those are three things that he's got to do immediately. Really, and how he's going to do that is—it's very clear that he and his colleagues have decided to do is to reinvigorate the grassroots nature of the Bolivarian Revolution, and to go down to the grassroots again. One of the criticisms that's made here is that the leadership tended to allow itself to drift away from its grassroots support. Now, and we'll see whether or not that's a fair criticism over the next few months. But one of the clear things, implicitly, Nicolas Maduro is recognizing that criticism because he's saying that that's what they've got to do.
Right.
You've probably talked to better informed people about this over the last few days, but I should imagine that the people with more direct experience of Venezuela, not looking at it from afar as I do, will confirm that one of the crucial things that is now in process is an effort by the leadership and structures of the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues, to get back in touch with grassroots support.
Right. Yeah, I mean, over the course of the week, I spoke with Eric Dratzer, who's from New York, but he spent a week down there, and so he was observing the run-up to the election and the aftermath and out in the streets talking with people. I also spoke yesterday with Gloria Lariva, who's been down there a number of times. She's consulted with Maduro and, before that, Hugo Chavez, and has been going to Venezuela on and off over the last 16 years. But and also with Caleb Maupin, who's also from New York, who was also down there as an election observer, and he'd been down there a number of times before. But perspective that is most useful that you bring to this that none of them have is your experience with exactly this situation in Nicaragua over the past decade and a half, and that's what we're talking about really is exactly what I wanted to get into, looking at the dynamics that exist and the types of actions that can be taken to move forward basically and to rebuild a link between the streets and the party structure, the leadership, whatever. Which is the task, and clearly the right knows this as well, and the United States knows this as well, because the economic troubles that have been imposed on Venezuela were intended, obviously, to alienate the masses from the socialist leadership.
Yeah, taking up your point about what the Venezuelan government might do. And one of the key, I'm going back to grassroots and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the key things that Daniel Ortega did, more than any other politician in Nicaragua, the only one that he came anywhere near close to the kind of popular, the popular contact, grassroots contact that Daniel Ortega had, was Arnoldo Alemán. Arnoldo Alemán had the common touch, and for people who don't even know who Arnoldo is, Arnoldo Alemán was a very talented right-wing leader, far more talented than any of the leaders in Venezuela, in my opinion.
Yeah.
What he did was he achieved what most people would have thought absolutely impossible, and he achieved unity among the Nicaraguan right wing. No, that sounds stupid, doesn't it?
No.
But it was a very, very a talented political achievement back in 1995-1996, and Arnoldo Alemán did that, and he became president in 1996, although many people believe that his election was marred by widespread fraud, but that's, you know, that's water under the bridge, isn't it? And he, and what happened with the reason Arnoldo Alemán was able to marginalize all his competitors on the right wing was because he went out and spoke to people at grassroots. Now, he was not as good at that as Daniel Ortega. Right. Daniel Ortega has a supreme talent for reaching out to people and relating to people and making contact with people and engaging people at every level. Right. And he all through the 90s, he actually wore himself out. And I think it seriously affected his health, the massive effort that he made to travel all over Nicaragua, to the most remote parts of Nicaragua, and to places that you could only reach on a mule, you know? Mm. And that's, I'm not exaggerating, and that's what Daniel Ortega did for all through the 90s and into the early part of the 2000s.
Well, he had crawled around on the floor of the jungle for a decade or two before that to build resistance to the dictator Somoza.
Well, yeah, and my partner, I absolutely adore, and she was a fighter at the. Sorry. Hmm. She was a fighter at the age of 17, and she was trained by Daniel Ortega. Mm. Wow. Sorry, Don.
It's okay. Yeah.
So look, and Daniel Ortega has this tremendous gift, and he used it to great advantage all through the 1990s and the early 2000s. And that is why people believe and trust Daniel. Because he's spoken to huge numbers of people. I remember one in the 2006 election coming. He's also extremely determined, and this is, I'm sure that Nicolas Maduro has learned a lot from Daniel. But just to give you an example of what I mean, in 2006 he came to speak in Esteli, and it was raining, and I was there. Waiting to listen to what he had to say, and originally when he started his speech, there were kind of maybe 300 people there in the election meeting. This was well before the actual election, and as it rained, people drifted away. They all drifted away, and I ended up walking off as well because I'm. But before I did, and I saw Daniel Ortega standing there under an umbrella, giving his speech. You know, he's absolutely iron self-discipline, and that's another thing that characterizes Daniel Ortega. He's got this great gift of the common touch and being able to engage with everybody. But he's also got this iron self-discipline, no doubt derived from his days as a guerrilla fighter, you know, with a handful of comrades fighting against one of the best armed dictatorships in Latin America.
Right.
And so, you know, and if Nicolas Maduro has the advice of people like Daniel Ortega and the advice of people like Fidel Castro and Raul Castro, he is going to take the lessons that they have to impart to him, and he'll put them into practice. And I'm very encouraged by the fact that, from what I can read, of what's going on in Venezuela, that he's actually doing that. And he and his colleagues have to get out, and they have to go to the very last corner of Venezuela and talk to everybody. And that's what Daniel Ortega did. And that is why he was able to maintain sufficient support to be able to be in a position in 2006 to take advantage of the divisions of the right wing. And so what Nicolas Maduro has to do is he has to learn from those experiences, and as well as in setting things right in terms of the economy, and as well as building the enough support to be able to resist a recall referendum. And he also has to exploit divisions in the right wing, which, you know, they undoubtedly exist. Please excuse me.
Yeah.
So then, and immediately that is the scenario that faces Nicolas Maduro.
Yeah, and you know, there's looking at you know, the gearing up for that battle. You know, you have the bulk of the media in private hands in Venezuela, as in most of the region, and the state media, the public media, which was targeted during the coup, for example, in 2002, and again when there were right-wing uprisings. You know, an attempt to basically hand a complete monopoly of information over to the right, with the National Assembly in charge of the purse strings and also in charge of some of the staffing and other things, and they've actually announced their intent to do this. You're going to see an attack on the public media, so that as the rest of the battle unfolds, that it will be a very one-sided narrative that's being conveyed to the people in the streets.
Yeah, and that's another reason why it's so important for Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues to get out and engage people at grassroots. Can I interrupt you, Dom?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
I just something that people may not have kind of thought about is that if Nicolas Maduro wants to, and if his colleagues want to, they themselves can push for a recall referendum, dissolve the National Assembly, and call new elections if they win the recall referendum.
What's the mechanism for that?
I'm not a constitutional expert by any means with regard to Venezuela, but as I understand it, say for example that the right wing go for a recall referendum. Or say, for example, that they try and take action against Nicolas Maduro's vice president, because that's something that they can do with their supermajority. They can actually ask for the destitution of the vice president. But if they do that, this is something that I do understand about the Venezuelan constitution, if they do that, the president then has the right to call new elections, to dissolve the assembly and call new elections.
Really? Well, could they possibly be foolish enough to do that?
Well, we'll see, won't we? And you see, there's so many variables, aren't there, Don? And what looks like a massive defeat now could turn around in 6 months. And opinion could turn, especially if the opposition show themselves to be the incompetent and corrupt individuals that we believe them to be. You know, and let's see what happens over the next 6 months, and let's see how the patterns of popular support develop over the next 6 months. And the situation may look very different in 6 months. And was it Harold Wilson that said, a week is a long time in politics? You know, and let's see what happens. So, you know, and let's see how it all pans out. And is the Argentinian electorate sufficiently kind of under the influence of unspecified substances to enable Mauricio Macri to fool them into putting up with him for his full 4-year term? We'll see.
You know,
and the same applies, you know, the same applies in Brazil, the same applies in Venezuela, in all these countries where the right wing seem to be in the ascendant for the moment. The question is, are the majority of people among the electorates in these countries going to allow these right-wing phonies to deceive them, and how long for?
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.